For the week of June 25th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 372, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And back in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
You literally flew across the country, and by fly I mean drive, okay, because you were actually driving, but you went really fast. Last week at this time, you were in Gallup, New Mexico, you went all the way up to San Francisco, and then all the way back across the country, all the way down to Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes, I did. It stopped with some friends along the way, but I didn't dilly-dally, but I didn't take it hard. You know, I wasn't pushing it. You could do it in 3 days. I did it in four, which is pretty leisurely. It was a lot of fun.
You know, I tried to figure out a way to do to train across the country. It's really hard.
Yeah, it is now. Yeah. Though in our rush last week, I did fail to mention, I was so concerned when we talked about Yoko Ono and the possibility that she'll be added to the songwriting credits for Imagine, I failed to point out the one interesting thing about this. If they give her songwriting credit as a co-writer on Imagine, the John Lennon classic, that is one of the most valuable and beloved songs in pop music history, that means it will stay out of the public domain about another 40 years. So that's actually really significant financially. So while the money is all going to the same estate, if they extend it to her as a living person, that extends the copyright. And that's kind of interesting. That's a side element to it. But I was so worried that we're not paying her as a dragon lady and scheming to get her name on it that I forgot to point out that interesting element.
Well, I mean, look, when we covered the story, John Lennon himself, days before his assassination, was saying, hey, she deserved credit on it.
That's true. You know, he died in the early 80s. I remember it well. And unfortunately, he never lived in the era of podcasts. Maybe he would have had one himself. He certainly would have listened to our show. And if he did this week, what would he be hearing about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to head to...
Strike!
What are you talking about?
Strike!
We're heading to China, okay? Okay.
Why am I striking?
I have no. Oh, wait a second. Did those guys, the SAG and the AFTRAs, did they do a thing where they kind of said, okay, we're authorizing a strike. If you don't agree to what we want, we're authorizing a strike.
Make it sound so petty. That's what happens when negotiations break down. You turn and say, we're serious now. This isn't working, and we're going to strike. That's exactly what happened. But that's not why I'm yelling strike.
Oh, why are you yelling strike?
I am yelling strike because you promised on this week's show we would talk about that email.
Oh, yes.
Now you're telling me it's too long. We don't want to jump over it. We want to give it its full due, and we're going to have to wait another week to hear about an email from our reader explaining an issue.
Yes. Why SiriusXM purchased 20% of Pandora for $500 million.
Well, I won't go on strike, but you have to promise no matter what, next week, you know, this is the 2 week cliffhanger. We will talk about this email.
Yes, I feel like
it's the greatest email of all time.
Exactly, we were preempted by current events. I also feel like you know, this is what happens when we try and tease things.
Which you shouldn't do.
Exactly.
I beg you not to. But anyway, what's happening on this week's show? We can tease that because it will happen.
Well, okay. So then I'm going to tease our trip to China. Because, well, as you know, Mike, it's really big and a lot is happening in China. We have so much to keep track of. Maybe we should move the Showbiz Sandbox headquarters to Beijing. What do you say, Michael? We could do that, right?
We could. I might suggest Hong Kong.
Oh,
might be
okay.
A little better. I've got my yellow umbrella. Or perhaps Macau. We could, you know, gamble by night and do the show by day.
I would actually be broke within about the first 10 minutes. Now, during our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to try to limit yourself to two great books that need to become movies, and they need to become movies ASAP. On Inside Baseball, we'll dive deeper into the firing of the duo behind the Star Wars spinoff about young Han Solo and what a headache it will cause for the DGA. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines, but first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's where we start, and then we pull information from everywhere else. Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, Box Office, Mojo, Box Office, Profit, you name it. And you, the readers, you send in info as well. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, Transformers: The Last Night. $241 million on the weekend. It opened on Wednesday in the U.S. and some other places. The total worldwide after 5 days or so is $265 million worldwide, including more than $100 million in China, which is really coming through for Transformers. So this is a big success story. In North America, it opened low, only $70 million. It's the lowest in the franchise. But you know what? The last movie made $800+ million internationally. That's where this movie matters. And so, of course, you get more money out of North America because you get 50%. But when all is said and done, if they can gross $1 billion again, they'll be just fine. So this movie is a success. It's a hit commercially. Pointing out that it didn't do well in North America is kind of like looking at a movie's box office in North America and saying, you know what? It underperformed in New York and California, but the heartland loves it. So it's okay. Wherever you make your money, you're making money.
Well, yeah, you can always see now after one of these movies opens, these Transformers movies or, you know, a big popcorn blockbuster movie that doesn't necessarily live up to the expectations or falls just short or at the low end of expectations in North America. You always see the head of distribution for the studio saying, look, we made this movie for the world. This is a worldwide movie, which is always a sign of, yeah, okay, didn't do as well here. We kind of thought that might happen. We thought maybe it could do a little bit better. It didn't, but guess what? We're already in the black.
Well, they're not already in the black. Well, it costs $220 million to make, but they're not lying when they say they made the movie for the world. If your movie costs $200 million to make, you must make money worldwide or you will lose it. You're not going to make $1 billion in North America, with the rarest of exceptions. So, you know, that's true. But somebody writing about the movie, was it box office profit? They called it Transformers with the four in Transformers. I'm like, oh, they really missed one on that. That would have been great. An easy way to say it's the fourth in the franchise. But anyway, Wonder Woman is number two around the world. That's both a critical and a commercial success story. A lot more fun for Warner Brothers to talk about Wonder Woman than Paramount to have to explain why Transformers not doing so great in the U.S. doesn't matter. By the way, what about toys? If they get a piece of that, that can't hurt. Wonder Woman grossed $45 million on the weekend. It hit $650 million worldwide. It's the highest grossing movie ever directed by a woman, perhaps including worldwide. We know that's true in North America, where it's grossed a very hearty $300 million. So that movie is on fire, doing great. At number three around the world is Cars 3. Bit of a disappointment for Pixar so far. $37 million on the weekend. It dropped pretty hard in North America. It's grossed $141 million worldwide. It has many territories to go. And again, the toys are where the action is on this one, exponentially so. So we're going to hold our breath. But certainly it's untypical or atypical, I should say, for a Pixar or most family films to drop so hard in its second weekend. They usually have better legs than that. And given that this one opened poorly and is sort of a beloved series, it's worth noting.
Yes, two things worth noting. You mentioned the toys with Cars 3. Again, this is a franchise that has earned over $10 billion since its inception in merchandise alone. And also overseas, so in Europe, in parts of Asia, this movie won't be opening until midsummer, late summer, into September and August, you know, September and October, based on certain holidays and seasonal elements. So it has not opened everywhere yet.
No, it's only in 27 territories. It has a long way to go, and that's why we always wait until all the dollars are in. At number four, we're still counting the money for The Mummy. $22 million on the weekend, $340 million worldwide. That's just about triple its reported budget of $125 million, but I'm putting a big asterisk by that one because that may be the budget somebody has reported, but when you've got Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe in your movie, you're going to need to make a little bit extra coin.
Yeah, they're definitely, you know, the industry pundits are painting this one as a huge disappointment and a lost opportunity for Universal, which was hoping to use The Mummy as a way to kind of kick off a monster franchise with, you know, Jekyll and Hyde and The Mummy and Frankenstein. And I don't know if they're going to be able to do it. I mean, I'm sure they'll try, but I don't know if this was the way to do it.
Well, obviously they want them, but the way to do it is to have a bigger critical and commercial hit. But it's got $270 million internationally. It's underperformed in the U.S. with just $70 million. But Tom Cruise is a big star overseas. And has it opened yet in China?
I believe it has.
Oh, it is. Okay. So that would be their big, you know, shining hope would be that China would really perform well because Tom Cruise is really scoring big there. I'm scrolling down and The Mummy opened June 9th. So yes, it did.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, here we go. It made 74 million renminbi. I can never pronounce that. Basically made $10.8 million this weekend.
Okay. And number five is another franchise on the ropes. Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales. $13 million on the weekend, $670 million worldwide. You know, it's a fading franchise. They'll probably get by on the skin of their teeth on this one when all is said and done. But if the people at Disney are thinking, maybe we can squeeze out one more Pirates movie, I would say you just did.
Yes, exactly. You know, everybody's talking in North America about sequelitis, okay? And Jim Amos over at Celluloid Junkie, shameless plug, I was reading his piece, his box office piece last night, and he was talking about how international always seems to be about 5 years behind where North America is box office-wise, like the box office trends. And he said, you know, we're experiencing sequelitis here in North America for the most part. Everybody's talking about sequelitis. What's going to happen in 5 years when all of a sudden all of these sequels no longer bring in the money internationally that they are today?
Are we seeing 3D trend down internationally? I believe we are.
Exactly. Just like, you know, everybody, you know, you can almost, you know, where North America goes 5 years later, 5 to 6 years later, most of the rest of the world goes, at least for now. Maybe that will shift a little bit over time as things tend to do.
But we've been spoiled in a world where you can make 7 or 8 Harry Potter movies and they all make the same amount of money, which is, in the old days, was unprecedented. And when you've got, this is the fifth Pirates movie, they should be thrilled that they're, you know, that the series has done as well as it has and pat themselves on the back and move on. And I don't think there's ever sequelitis. There's just bad movie-itis.
Yeah, well, you know what? They should have been, you know, thrilled after the first movie did well.
Well, they were. Yeah. And number six around the world is Baywatch. A movie that tried to spoof a TV show that was already spoofing itself in a way. You know, you can't make fun of a show that's dumb to begin with. It grossed $11 million on the weekend, and it's just about $140 million worldwide. And number seven is a shark movie, 47 meters down. It stars Mandy Moore and Matthew Modine. Good to see Matthew Modine back in the mix. It grossed $7 million on the weekend, and because it's a low-budget movie, that $25 million take worldwide is really good news, and that's just from North America so far. There's two other little territories, but basically that's all from the U.S. and Canada.
Well, and I think it would have done better here in the U.S. if they had called it, "141 feet down" instead of 47 meters.
At number eight is Despicable Me 3. That's just opened up in 6 territories, pretty small ones, I guess. $7 million on the weekend, $19 million worldwide. It's going to open up here, I think, this week or next week, very soon. And it's a big, big franchise, both Despicable Me and The Minions. And I'm just wondering, you know, the budgets for these movies are famously low at Universal, like under $100 million, a very tight budget for an animated movie. But surely Steve Carell and Kristen Wiig at this point are saying, yeah, it was really nice making a movie my kids could see, but how much money did you make?
Yeah.
You know, their ticket price to do these voices has to be going up.
I would say it definitely is. And I would not be shocked if each one of them is making between $5 and $10 million per
movie.
That's
way low on a franchise that's grossing close to, you know, $800-900 million. That's incredibly low. They shouldn't be making $5 million. They should be making a lot more. That's my point.
Well, and they might have, you know, back end participation, although again, you know, what does that really mean?
It means a lot if it's triggered by gross. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't care how they get the money. I'm just saying they should be making a lot more. At this point, the third movie in the franchise, grossing, you know, making money hand over fist, they surely are not doing it for the love. At number nine is All Eyes on Me, the Tupac Shakur biopic. $7 million on the weekend, $43 million worldwide. It has a $40 million budget, so we'll have to see where it ends up. And it has started to open up overseas, so we'll have to see how well Tupac's legend lives in the international market.
Well, here it dropped 78%. That's huge. I mean,
in North America, it did. Yes, it was not a good movie. People turned out on opening weekend for it. It's not getting great word of mouth, but, you know, if they can make, they made $40 million in the U.S., if they can make, you know, $80 million overseas, they'll be fine. That
well, you
could
know
be
what?
A long road to hoe, but we'll see. Long road to hoe? What the hell am I saying? That could be difficult. And number 10 is Rough Night, a girls' night out movie. $7 million on the weekend, $25 million worldwide. And number 11, Captain Underpants, the first epic movie. $5 million on the weekend, $72 million worldwide. Guardians of the Galaxy crossed $850 million worldwide. And then we're coming down. I'm skipping a few movies. Number 15 is 77 Heartbreaks. This is a Chinese romantic comedy. I'm sorry, no, a Chinese romantic drama about a young couple who are together for 10 years. Then the girl suddenly dumps him. The guy's like, what? And he finds a diary or a journal of hers and realizes he has broken her heart 77 times. And he wants to win her back. He realizes what a jerk he's been. And the last page of the journal is leading up to a secret, some way that, you know, might make her happy or he could win her back possibly, but it's been ripped out. So he has to go through all realizing what a jerk he's been and try and woo her back. It sounds interesting. It grossed $2.5 million on the weekend. It's at $3 million and counting. It's from the director Herman Yao. I hope I'm saying his name right. And it's written by Erica Lee. They've teamed up on a number of movies. He's done a lot of films. And they together have done a number of movies. And this one is based on her best-selling novel. I don't know about you, but it sounds like a commercial idea to me. I love the title. I love the concept. And it sounds to me like somebody in Hollywood should be snapping this up if they haven't already.
If I was a studio executive, I would be wanting to see this movie right now.
I wouldn't. I would just take the concept. I think, you know, however it works, you can make it work, even if it didn't in the original. I wasn't at Sundance. I've never been. But one of the movies debuting this week is Beatrice at Dinner. And it grossed $1.8 million. No, it's already been open, I guess.
Yes.
Or maybe it opened on a Wednesday. It's grossed $3 million so far since it opened. It stars Salma Hayek and John Lithgow. And it's a drama about how you shouldn't invite a member of the 99% to your dinner party for the 1%. Doesn't work out well. Mike Wright wrote the script. Miguel Arteta directed. Did you see it?
I have not seen it, no. But
oh,
I'm sorry
to bring it up.
Yes, I hear very good things about it.
All right. And skipping down, another movie that is opening up is, I think it's opening up, it's Paths of the Soul. As far as this movie opened, it made $1.4 million on the weekend. It's at $2.4 million and counting. It's, if I'm right, it is this film about Tibetans on a pilgrimage to their major pilgrimage city. It's a docudrama. It's a Chinese film. But I'm just not sure if it's that movie. That movie came out and was in festivals in 2015. It had a commercial release somewhere in 2016, I think Japan. And maybe this is that film. I couldn't find another one. If I'm right, or if you know what movie this is, let us know.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can look us up on Facebook at, I was almost going to repeat our Twitter handle, but if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, you will find our page and you can like us there.
That's right. And two more movies I'll mention. One towards the bottom is Lion. That's the Weinstein movie, The Weepy, that was an Oscar hopeful. And it made $1 million this weekend. That's the film starring Sonny Pawar and Dev Patel as the little kid who's reunited with his family thanks to Google Maps. You remember that movie now. So it opened up in a new territory. It's in six territories right now. That movie has grossed $145 million worldwide on a $12 million budget. Yet again, the Weinsteins pulled it out. But one more opening. This is interesting. It's called Tube Light. It's an Indian drama. It's written and directed by Kabir Khan and produced and starring Salman Khan. I don't believe they're related. It's clearly a passion project for the star, Salman Khan, if not, in fact, a vanity project, because it certainly didn't get good reviews. And it's based on the unsuccessful U.S. indie film called Little Boy. And it takes place during the 1962 Chinese-Indian War, which I don't know much about, and I looked it up. And fascinatingly, this is when China and India had a border dispute and China invaded India, you know, sent troops over the border, a huge international crisis. It happened in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. During those 13 days, China attacked India. So you had the U.S. and the Soviet Union going at it in Cuba. You had China and India going at it in their border. It's like, dear God, the world was destabilized.
Kind of like it is right now.
Well, no, there's not war looming. The people aren't rattling the sabers quite like four big superpowers. And in fact, one of the reasons it got to the level it was because the Soviet Union and the U.S. were not engaged. They were a little busy at the time. And so there was no way to have other countries back them up or maybe help defuse the situation. But that's the worldwide box office.
Well, and I'd kind of like to point to two films that opened, at least in North America in limited release. The Beguiled, we've talked about before, Michael, because it was in Cannes this year. This is the Sofia Coppola film, which I can recommend. I could recommend seeing that. It's a kind of a remake, though based on a book. So
it's a remake of a Clint Eastwood film set in the Civil War, and which was originally based on a novel.
Right.
But I have to apologize because my impression from all the reviews I read at Cannes was that this was going to be lambasted by the critics. And in fact, in North America, looking through a bunch of the critic reviews, which is the one way I use Rotten Tomatoes, I don't look at the number. I go to see what did they actually say, the critics I recognize. And in fact, they were pretty friendly to it. Very few people loved it, but they were more polite than I expected. So I stand corrected on that one.
Yeah, I would say exactly that, Michael. It's you know, nothing that you walk out going, that was amazing. It's life-changing. But you can walk out going, oh, that was a solid movie. However, I would say The Big Sick, which is only on 5 screens right now, $87,000 per screen is what it made this weekend, making it the highest per screen average opening to date in 2017. That is a film that was picked up at Sundance for $12 million by Amazon Studios. It's worth seeking out and finding.
No movies gross more than 87 per screen? Really? That's interesting.
I would point out
for all the attention that Sofia Coppola's movie got and the fact that I apologize for the reviews, that her film, basically on the same number of screens with all the attention, it stars Nicole Kidman and Colin Farrell and Kirsten Dunst. It was outscored by The Big Sick, which stars Kumail Nanjiani and Zoe Kazan. So that's pretty notable. When you're looking at these movies expanding, which The Beguiled is going to do next week, I wouldn't be as excited as maybe they think they are.
Yes, I would agree with you. I think The Big Sick is headed toward an end-of-year run that's going to be much kinder to it.
That's right. But of course, another movie that maybe isn't going to be an Oscar contender, but it's gotten a lot of good critical buzz, and that's Baby Driver.
Yes, this was a film they showed about 10 minutes of it at CinemaCon back in March, and everybody went nuts. This is a film everybody's looking at going, that thing could be a real hit, because certainly the footage that everybody's seen looks fantastic. It's got some, movie
stars. What kind of genre is it? What kind of film is it?
It's, here's the thing. It's a jukebox musical action comedy film, to which I say, gee, look at all those genres. Why not throw in romance, horror, and animation just to round out the genre-defying film? Why not?
Well, the good news they have this week is good buzz and the fact that they passed the Chinese censors. Was that going to be difficult? Was there a sense that it had a lot of stuff that might be difficult?
No, I think this was just one of those things where, it doesn't have a release date yet. Nobody knows if it's even going to be released in the country, although I think it's going to be released in the country. And you know why, Michael? I think China's going to release this film because right now, 80% of all ticket sales in China for this year have come from imported movies.
That's only the period of that since the New Year, I believe.
Yes, you're right.
Since the Chinese New Year. And again, this is a period where almost all the movies released have been North American. So that's yes, in this period in which all the movies released have been U.S. films, the big ones, all the Chinese guns open before the New Year. So yeah, in this period, they've been releasing a lot of U.S. films, and yes, they've been grossing most of the money. So it's slightly misleading.
Well, okay.
It's all U.S. films being released. Of course, they're releasing, winning most of the money. Their competition is a small little romantic drama,
What, 77 Heartbreaks?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well,
there's money to be made in China, and Disney's doing that too, right? Why is this interesting? Disney has unveiled their first Chinese language romantic comedy. They're backing a film in China, basically. Is that what we're saying?
Yes, they're basically saying, hey, you know what? You probably don't always want to see, Alien or, pick a film, pick a Disney film. You might want to see some homegrown films with homegrown talent in your native language. So they've started to make such films, and they've just announced a romantic comedy. It's their first Chinese language film production. I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think it's called
The Dreaming Man.
The Dreaming Man. It's a co-production, like most of those productions are, between Walt Disney Studios China Limited. So there you go. They have to open up a Chinese company to actually be able to do this. And some other Chinese companies, SMG Pictures, for instance. These are all companies you've never heard of and may never hear of. Shooting is already done, and they announced it at the Shanghai Film Festival, which was taking place last week.
But- But isn't this just a long range thing that Hollywood's been doing? They back movies in India, they back movies in Italy, they back movies in local production in France, just like the TV studios are doing. I mean, isn't this just part and parcel of what everybody's been doing?
Yeah, Sony did India, okay, and Fox is doing Indonesia right now, and this is Disney's first foray into Chinese language films, and I think it might be, you know, a big American studio's first foray in earnest into making Chinese language movies.
And of course, the opposite happens, that Chinese companies are taking an interest in U.S. movies. We looked last week at the odd, unusual jump onto Transformers and why that would happen minutes before the movie opened. Suddenly you had multiple partnerships with Chinese companies. We had our own explanation for that. But now we have it happening here with a Tom Cruise movie. The Chinese theater chain Dadi, which is getting bigger and bigger and wants to challenge Wanda, obviously, they took a piece of the Tom Cruise movie American Made. That's a Universal film. Doug Liman directed it. It's an $80 million movie. It's a drama with Tom Cruise starring on the true story of this pilot for TWA who got fired in the 70s, started working for the Medellin cartel, smuggling in drugs to North America. He gets caught, arrested, convicted, and says, I could wear wire. And starts being an informant for the DEA. So it's a crazy true story. It was supposed to come out in January. They pushed it back to September, which means either they're excited by it or they're not excited by it or they can't figure out what to do with it. Who knows? I think maybe it shows confidence in it. But of course, he's a big star overseas, and now this theater chain has bought a piece of it. But it's far in advance, so it doesn't seem as strange and unusual as what happened last week.
Right. Now, last week we said, well, this might be happening as a way for American studios to get money out of China, because that is one way to kind of get money out, is that you have somebody invest in your company. And of course, you don't have to worry about the currency exchanges and the laws surrounding currency leaving the country in China.
Right. You say, okay, we expect to make $40 million. We'll sell off that $40 million potential gross for $25 million. And if you reach it, great, you win. You get an extra $15 million. But at least we get the studio our $25 million out of that country.
Right. And oh, by the way, we've already seen the film. We know what it's capable of doing here, around the world, and possibly in China. I don't know why they're calling these marketing deals. I guess maybe the theater chains are paying for some of the marketing. It's a way to ensure bookings. That's
obvious.
Obvious. Yeah. So that might be why they're saying, look, if it ensures the booking and you're willing to pay us to ensure the booking, sure, why not?
And there's no reason to wait until a week before the movie comes out. That seems to be, we're not, again, sure why that happened. This makes more sense. It looks less suspicious. Not that any of it may be legal or illegal. We don't know. But if that's the idea, hey, we want to get our money out of this country, we better sell off pieces of our movie before it opens to a local company just so we can get some money. Well, it seems to be perhaps what's going on more and more in China. But we know that there's always a sort of impenetrable stuff going on. You don't know which government agency is fighting with which other one. Just because it's a one communist party rule does not mean everybody's on the same page. And now we have the biggest theater in chain is Wanda, and they're sort of having trouble, aren't they?
Yeah, and I have to say, I have been waiting for this to eventually happen. So you just mentioned Dadi, Michael, which is the second largest Chinese.
Third, I believe, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you know what it is. By screen count in China, it's the third largest, but now they own a whole bunch of cinemas outside of China, so they might be one of the largest in Asia. But yeah, it's like, depends on how you're counting screens, right? I mean, that's okay. But yes, in China, Wanda is the biggest. Wanda Cinema Line is the name of the company. And if that name sounds familiar, they are a part of the Dalian Wanda Group, a big real estate company. Guess what? That company also owns a little theater chain in the U.S. called AMC.
Right. And the China Banking Regulatory Commission is looking into what they are doing and how the debt they're piling up and how they're financing all these acquisitions. So this is what we're talking about, the fact that they are being investigated by a government agency.
Right. I thought, wow, where are you getting all this money? You bought Hoyts in Australia. You bought Odeon in the U.K. You bought the Nordic Cinema Group. And you're doing this really quickly and with a lot of debt. So where are you getting this money? How are you getting this money out of the country? What's going on here with all of these loans that you're taking? And sure enough, the China Banking Regulatory Commission is reported, it's not certain, to be looking into what, you know, some of, and it's, by the way, not just the Dalian Wanda Group, it's other groups as well Okay, so it's these groups that are acquiring a lot of companies outside of China. They're going, what's going on here? Again, these are just reports. When that announcement, well, it wasn't an announcement, when those rumors, so to speak, those press reports were published, the Wanda Group's stock plummeted by 10%, causing Wanda to seek a halt of trading for its own stock. And then they came out and said, look, none of this is true. Okay, so it's not true. Please keep buying
their stock.
Well,
they didn't say it's not true that the government is looking into us, did they? I thought they just said, hey, everything's fine.
They said that the reports are erroneous.
Right. But that doesn't mean that they're not being spoken to by the CBRC. I think they were vague. They're like, hey, calm down. Everything's fine. As opposed to openly immediately denying that the CBRC was looking into them or have the government confirm that. That's not what happened. They just said, don't worry. What are you people upset about? Everything's going to be fine. But the point is, the CBRC is not necessarily saying that something is going on illegally. It's just that this is what everybody is suddenly doing. Local governments, other companies are amassing massive amounts of debt to acquire stuff all over the world. And they're sort of just saying, hey, this is a lot of debt. What's going on here? We want to make sure we're not getting a house of cards here. And that's what I think is happening, that they're just saying, this is concerning. There's so much debt piling up. We want to see what's going on, catch our breath. And it's part of the whole move to make sure too much money is not flowing out of the country.
Right. And because last November, of course, China made it a lot harder to get yuan out of the country. And they devalued the yuan. This is, part of the whole currency manipulation issue that many people have pointed at China for. And they're looking at the people loaning the money to all of these companies that are doing the acquiring and saying, is this your way of getting money out of the country? You're giving it to these, third-party companies to go and acquire another company in another country. And then when you get paid back, it will be outside of China. Is this what's going on here? Who knows? But now you have all of these, Chinese government agencies looking into it.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. We'll keep our eye on that.
Well, and I'm sure at some point, if there is any truth to any of this, mark my words, Michael, you know this more than anybody, someone will write a book about it someday.
Absolutely.
And that's my way of saying it's time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And every week, you and your team over at Book Filter select a whole bunch of books that we should be paying attention to. And here on Showbiz Sandbox, you bring just a few that might make good movies or television shows. What do you have for us this week?
Well, this week I have two books that I couldn't resist talking about. One, I'm only halfway through. It's driving me nuts. I really want to finish it, but I've been on the road. It's called Spoonbenders by Daryl Gregory. And the pitch that I got was that it's about a family of psychics who are sort of unmasked on the Mike Douglas Show, which is a TV talk show back in the 70s, and they fall into infamy and disrepute, but they are actually psychic, and they're working with the government to help fight the Soviets, and they're on hard times, and it just sounded fun and poppy and kind of, might be amusing, and I started to read it, and it's actually, it's fun and poppy, but it's really good, and it's not just like a thriller or a fun lark. It's like, these people are complex and interesting and kind of sad sacky because the psychic abilities aren't so great. And it's really, really interesting. It's a really substantial novel. It is not just an airport read. It's fun. It's easy to read, but it's really good. I've really been happy with it. I wish I'd finished it.
Wait a second. Is it a novel or is it a nonfiction book?
Oh, it's a novel. Yes.
Okay.
No, they're actual psychics. So it is in fact a novel because there's no such thing as psychics.
Okay.
The other book is a memoir. It's a true story. It's called My Glory Was I Had Such Friends. And it's by Amy Silverstein, who like almost 30 years ago got a heart transplant as a young person. And she lived with it for 26 years. And then she needs another one. And if she doesn't get it, she's going to die. And the only way to do that was to upend her life and leave this coast and move all the way to California, because that's where she was going to be prepositioned to potentially get a heart if it happens and it can work. That's a huge thing. She told all her friends, and her friends said, we're there. And what happened was, she's in California and all her life is back on the East Coast. And she had 9 friends who didn't even all know each other, and they worked together. They did an online schedule. They made sure there was somebody always out in California with her, if not more than one person, bucking her up, keeping her alive, fighting with her to stay focused and positive and energetic. And it was like a round robin of friends flying out to LA. I can be there for this week. This person, that'll be there for next week. And they just kept going out there and helped keep her alive and keep her spirits up. And it's just a really inspiring, lovely little story. And it sounds like it'd make a tearjerker for sure. Because, you know, she wrote the book, so I'm assuming there's a happy ending.
Right, exactly. I was just going to say, you kind of know the ending, given that she wrote the book. But now here's my question. How do people get friends like that? I can't even find somebody to go to dinner with, okay? And this woman has people flying across the country 9 times a day to come and spend time with her. Ridiculous.
Yeah, it's true. But we do know the end story, perhaps, for Barnes & Noble. And it's not looking good because they've reported their first quarter sales for 2017 and sales are falling. So they're trying to crack the nut and figure out how to make their business plan work. They've got all sorts of models of new types of stores to deal with. They've got a new CEO in charge yet again. And they haven't turned that ship around yet. They haven't even slowed the sinking. So, you know, we're praying and hoping for them because the book industry needs Barnes & Noble. They need some big chains with a big footprint, and they're losing this one.
Well, I'll tell you, as I always mention whenever you bring up Barnes & Noble, it is the anchor tenant at a place right around the corner from me in Calabasas called The Commons. It's, you know, there's a few tenants that are anchor tenants. Ralph's is a grocery store. Barnes & Noble is another one of them. And if that store disappears, it would be huge for that complex. I mean, they would really struggle, I think.
Well, as you perhaps know, in the business sections of the newspapers and magazines, that there's a big fallout coming, we think, for the malls. People like going to the malls. They like shopping. They like walking around and having fun. Old people do it. Young people do it. It's a social communal thing. It's fun to see the things. But a lot of shopping is happening online. And it's really hurting, and we've been over-malled in America. There's way too many malls. So they're predicting like a third of all malls to disappear within 10 years because there's just no need for them. People are shopping a lot less there, and they may want a destination mall to go have a little fun, but they don't need 4 malls within a radius to go to. And so the retail section is really hurting. A lot of places like Macy's and JCPenney's and Sears are shutting down or shuttering stores. It's just going to get worse and worse. So Barnes & Noble is part of that whole story.
What was it that John Oliver said about JCPenney? He wasn't even sure that they were still around. He was shocked to hear that they were still around.
And that's right.
He thought you just kind of walked in and somebody handed you the keys and said, here, you see what you can do with it.
That's right. On my trip back from California, I went through, I think it was Missouri, where there was the JCPenney Museum and in the hometown home of the man who founded JCPenney. Sadly, I didn't have time to stop. There's also in Missouri, Walt Disney's home, a childhood home as well.
Yes, so, I think near Kansas City, actually.
Oh, well, there
think.
You go.
I could be wrong about that. Now,
well, that's, you know, it's a big deal. I wish that, you know, I love Walt Disney. He's a fascinating life. Love, I don't love him, but a fascinating life. JCPenney, kind of interesting, a fading icon of American retail business. I'm sorry I didn't get to stop.
You know, you were talking so fast there, but I do think you put two words together, which always tell me that it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines and entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about the Cannes Lions International Festival of Creativity, or as the event is more commonly known, the Cannes Lions, which was held last week in the south of France. Guess where, Michael? In Cannes. Go figure.
Oh.
Yeah, it's basically a conference for every aspect of the advertising industry, from the agencies that make ads and commercials to networks and media outlets which display and broadcast them. What was significant at this year's event was that 21st Century Fox's Fox Networks Group, okay, say that 5 times fast, they announced they would be adopting YouTube's 6-second ad format. They are the first broadcast television company to agree to the short, non-skippable video ad format, which YouTube introduced last year. So this little, my explanation of it took longer than it would take to watch an ad. Big deal, big whoop.
I'm confused. I thought there were lots of short little ads, and if you watched, like Hulu or a non-premium platform for some of these other websites, where there would be ads at the beginning of an episode or in the middle and the end that you couldn't skip. Were they just like 12 or 15 seconds long or something?
Yes, I think they were 15 seconds long. And what's the big deal here is that it's an actual broadcast television network agreeing to do it.
Well, but how can an ad on you're saying on Fox? I mean, I can understand on their platforms, like online, they could make it unskippable. How can an ad be unskippable if it's a network show, like airing on the network? If I DVR it, surely I can skip it.
This is only online.
Right. Okay. So we're talking about their online platform. So Fox.com's website, where they stream or make shows available on demand on a website, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, or on YouTube.
Or on YouTube. Okay. But they were doing it anyway. It's just a slightly shorter version.
Correct.
Okay. Why is it interesting? Is it like, it doesn't set a new pattern. I mean, they've been doing it. They're just like, 6 seconds, that works too. It's like, okay. And I'm, you know, I have to admit the 15 and 30 second ads when you can't skip them are really annoying. So I'm happy to have a 6 second ad. Did they decide, oh, that's the way to go. At least we'll get our message across, but people won't be pissed at us, or?
Yeah. I mean, look, what they're saying is, hey, people are watching these ads on mobile phones and smartphones and mobile devices. And if you're sending all of this data to them, this 15 second ad, it's chewing up their data and they're going to start getting annoyed and maybe not even coming to watch anything because they know they're going to have to sit through a 15 second ad. Okay. So that's one of the reasons they're doing this. The other reason is that, as YouTube says, that they created this ad unit as a balance between appreciable brand lift and optimal user experience. Okay.
The shorter, the better.
Yes, pretty much, yeah.
So the next ad will be, Despicable Me 3 opens Friday.
Yes, pretty much.
You're done. 3 second ad. Okay. But hey, that's YouTube, right? We got a story about YouTube.
I've got to warn you, Michael, this next story just makes me so cranky that as I was writing it, I thought, oh my God, this is literally a Lewis Black bit, okay?
Okay.
And I don't know if you know Lewis Black, but he's kind of cranky. And if you saw that movie Inside Out, he's anger, okay? You remember that?
I do. I remember on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart and from Inside Out. He's a cranky old man.
Yes. So if you could imagine a cranky old man saying, every tech and content company hoping to be taken seriously can't stop talking about what they think is the next big thing. Virtual reality, or VR, as the cool kids at E3 like to call it. Well, now YouTube has come up with its own VR format. They're calling VR 180. Apparently, it focuses on what's in front of the viewer in high resolution. Too bad nobody ever thought of television before. YouTube says that the format can even handle live streaming, so people can be in VR together. Here's a thought. How about taking off the funky-looking headgear and actually interact with one another for once? Big deal or big whoop?
It's the thousand voices of Sperling Reich.
That was really bad. You should see during rehearsal.
No, it wasn't bad at all, actually.
During rehearsal, I nailed it.
No, you were just fine. I was confused when I read this. I'm like, how is that virtual reality?
Yeah, I know.
I don't understand. Am I missing something? I don't understand. Is it going to have more sense of depth, or how is it VR if it's not surrounding you and you don't have to work? Do you have to wear glasses to view it, or what? What have they come up with?
Here's the thing. What it is it's not VR unless you put the goggles on and the cardboard glasses on and the device. Then it's just if it's you don't have any of that, it's just like a regular television or movie. It's just regular.
And why are they calling it VR 180? What is different than just watching high def whatever?
I have no idea. I'm assuming that it's not 360, that you don't turn your heads
on. It's not. It's called VR 180,
right?
But they say you can put on a visor and then see it in 3D. I guess it's more like a VR 180 with 3D.
Correct.
So it's streaming, but sort of 3D-ish because we use VR technology to do that.
Right. And the other thing is, oh, by the way, you can shoot it with regular cameras. You don't have to have special
cameras. No, no, really?
Yeah.
I read the story, I thought it said that they're working on the cameras and they'll be cheap and inexpensive, but I didn't realize that you could use your iPhone to shoot it.
I don't know about your iPhone.
Well, that's a traditional camera.
So YouTube promises that
it will be as easy to use as point and shoot camera.
Okay, I misread that.
For around the same price. It's a special camera. You can't just use any old camera. You have to use ones devoted to VR 180.
I'm out.
This is a format that is never going to go anywhere.
I'm out, yes.
This is stupid. They've wasted their time.
I guess one could say that about VR in general sometimes.
No. I have to say, I think I mentioned I tried on the VR goggles at my brother's house and they were cool. It was fun.
Yeah, I mean, but when it's done
right.
It's
not a killer app, but even the setup was very cool, where it looks like you're in this giant warehouse and there's a million things flipping up out of the floor and around here, and then boom, then you start whatever you do. But it was kind of neat.
Now, Michael, remember that time in the late 1990s when actor Daniel Day-Lewis proved that we are all underachievers by giving up his profession at the height of his career to become a cobbler in Italy?
I do, because my friend had a script about a cobbler in a small town in Italy that he traveled to and was desperately trying to get it to Dana DeLewis before this announcement. It would have been like, it would have kept him in the biz.
Yeah, well, he's, as you mentioned, Michael, he's doing it again, okay? He's, at least the retiring from acting bit, not sure about the cobbling bit. According to his publicist, Mr. DeLewis will no longer be working as an actor after his next film, an untitled movie from Paul Thomas Anderson, set in the fashion world of 1950s London. It's due out around Christmas of this year, so you guys, actually, you might want to get a title for that, okay?
Daniel Day-Lewis's last film.
Given that Day-Lewis is known for his intense method acting techniques, let's just hope that this is all part of some new role he is taking on to play a retiring three-time Oscar-winning actor. Big deal or big whoop.
What's wrong with my title for the movie? Daniel Day-Lewis's last film. That's what they should call it.
Actually, that people would probably go see that. So
I'd say, you know, it's one hopes that he will, you know, eventually find some. I'm sure he's sincere, but I hope eventually there's some project that interests him again, because he's one of the great actors of all time. So it would be a shame to lose him.
You know, I did not realize this. He is 60 years old.
Well, that's he's just a kid, a crazy kid with a dream, as was Bill Cosby, who had a trial and it was a deadlocked jury. So it was not that he was acquitted so much as they couldn't come to a conclusion. And now they're likely going to retrial again. But in the meantime, Bill Cosby's people announced he's going to go on a tour to talk about sexual assault and sexual harassment. And you think, okay, he wants to. No. He's going to go out and talk to people to teach them how to make sure you don't get caught or accused of sexually harassing someone. And he wants to focus on athletes and young black men. It's like, oh my God, can nobody in his camp tell him what to do? That's the worst idea I've ever heard of.
Now, almost as bad as going from a Daniel Day-Lewis story to a story about Bill Cosby going on trial for sexual assault, which is what that trial was about. So, yeah, I don't know if you noticed.
The idea he would go on tour and say, hey, you got to make sure you don't get caught. You know, it's like, that's not what he was literally saying. Don't put yourself in a position where someone might be able to accuse you. Maybe he has the Billy Graham idea of never being alone in a room with a woman, though I doubt it. But instead of saying sexual assault is bad, he's like, hey, let me teach you how not to get caught. It's like and he's going to be retried. So not a good idea.
Yeah, I thought the way that his team handled the whole, you know, ending of that trial and deadlock was not good.
Well, they got him not convicted, so they're happy.
Yeah, well, that might be that as it may. I just think that knowing that you will potentially and probably be put on trial again, you might want to handle things differently. Obviously, nobody can control anybody in that camp, so what's it matter? In the latest move of a big media company trying to gain some social media cred, or frankly, vice versa, Time Warner has announced they will be creating shows specifically for, now wait for it, okay? Get this, they're going to create shows for Snapchat. It's a 2-year deal that will see the media conglomerate develop and produce as many as 10 shows per year for the social networking app used by all the cool kids. No word on what the shows will be, though Time Warner did agree to advertise its cable networks like CNN, HBO, TBS, and TNT, and Warner Brothers Films during the course of this deal. All we do know is that the shows will be shot vertically, not horizontally. Each will be under 5 minutes long, and they will disappear immediately after viewing. Big deal, big word.
you seem very derisive about this.
I've tried to use Snapchat, okay? I get it, but I don't necessarily want to get it. I have no desire. I do know that people under the age of 30, between like 31 and down, they're on it all day long. This is like their messaging app. Frankly, I have no interest.
Well, that's because you're old.
Get me a wheelchair. And throw away my Snapchat.
Yeah, I've never used Snapchat myself particularly. And of course, when we're paying attention to know what it is, that means its day may be, you know, dwindling down. Kids don't use Facebook anymore, that's for sure. They're on it and their parents are linked to them. Like, yeah, okay, we got to go somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I've used it a couple times, and it's just one of those things where most of the people I know have tried to use it as well and said, this is stupid.
Right. So, well, everybody's got, and it's not as secure as one would hope or think. But the point is that everybody has a platform, and if you want to gain some audience, a lot of times you have to create original content, and that's what's happening here.
Now, about 10 years ago, Simon Tam decided to name his synth pop band The Slants. given that the entire band is Asian American, it was kind of a way to take a derogatory term often used against Asians and reappropriate it. But when he went to trademark the name, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office declined his request, citing an ancient law allowing them to deny marks that are, quote, scandalous, immoral, or disparaging. So Tam decided to duke it out with the government in a 7-year free speech legal case that made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in favor of Tam striking down the USPTO's law as unconstitutional. Now that Tam's band has a name they can actually trademark, they're moving on to their next big goal, signing a record contract. Big Giller, big whoop.
That's funny. I didn't know that they didn't have a record deal. Good for them.
Yeah, I mean, they're basically kind of a homegrown college band, right? I mean, that just kind of kept going.
So can NWA now get trademarked?
I guess so.
Actually, they were trademarked. The argument was that the full name of the band was not considered derogatory by their audience and the fans that used it that way. It was not considered disparaging, which I'm sure is the same thing that the Slants would say. So it's an interesting case. You know, you don't want the trademark office to be deciding ethical and, you know, legal things for you. If a name is offensive, then people maybe won't buy your product.
Right.
You know, let that be where it happens.
Well, and this, everybody points to the Washington Redskins, an American football team. Like, this is going to just allow them to keep that name.
Well, I think they've had trouble, right? They haven't been able to trademark it,
correct,
right?
Correct. They haven't been able to trademark it. And of course, that means that, you know, anybody can make t-shirts and hats and not have to pay a licensing fee. Well, now,
and of course, everybody wants them to dump the name because it's offensive.
Correct. Now, this next story just proves that the weak spot in my entertainment industry knowledge is definitely the reality television landscape. Because while I vaguely knew something was going on with Bachelor in Paradise, I didn't really care and paid no attention to it until, Michael, you put this story in our lineup. So apparently, they are shooting a 4th season of Bachelor in Paradise, this reality show I don't and probably never will watch. About 2 weeks ago, production on the new season was halted shortly after it began, after two of its cast members, Corinne Olympias and Demario Jackson, were allegedly caught on camera in questionable positions. Production was stopped, cast members and crew sent home from the Mexican location, and now they've managed to work something out, and production is ramping up again, though not in time for the scheduled August 8th debut. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And better yet, can someone please explain to me why I should care about this story at all?
Well, I tweaked the wording there because you mentioned that you had originally written that they were found in compromising positions, if you know what I mean. And of course, that's the point of these shows. People hooking up, people getting relationships, getting romantic, maybe kissing, maybe more. They often fade to black, but you know what's going on these reality shows. And you learn later, oh, yes, they were intimate with each other. So you've got all these reality shows where people are put together, sometimes have access to alcohol, and are having sex. And this is sort of the storyline. They're supposed to be falling in love, but they also fool around with each other. They get in hot tubs together. And on this show, apparently, there was something that happened that might have been a really big problem. You know, it's obviously looming over with a compromising position, somebody who's had too much to drink. A lot of shows are careful about the alcohol they make available. They don't show any footage that's racy or too much considered racy by their standards. And something went really wrong here. They shut down the entire production. People thought it was the end of the series. They thought, oh my God, this is going to change how reality shows are done. But somehow, against everybody's expectations, they're back to filming again. And they're like, we looked into it and we found we did nothing wrong. That's sort of the line of the production company behind the show. We didn't let anything happen that shouldn't have happened. We did everything right. Everything's fine. We've cleared ourselves. Meanwhile, the woman involved is saying, that's nice. I'm still going to sue.
Right.
So we're not done here, but it's a big mess and it's surprising. I guess in a way it hasn't happened sooner.
And Bill Cosby is now being hired as a consultant, I'm sure.
It has certainly made everybody pay more attention and rethink how they deal with alcohol on these sets. So a lot of them said, no, you know what? We never have like free bar open all the time with unlimited supply. We put out like a bottle or some beer, and then we decide whether we want to put more out. And make, you know, they're very careful about it. We're saying if they weren't careful, that was a big mistake. I'm sure they're going to even double down on that aspect of these shows.
I don't know what it is with our Big Deal Big Whoop segment this week, but it's all legal issues all the time. Political satirist and muckraker John Oliver did a piece on his HBO show mocking an oil company, and actually it's a coal mining
company. Coal company. Sorry about that.
And its chief executive. He started off by mentioning that for the first time in the show's history, they had actually received a letter from a lawyer for the company threatening to sue that if John Oliver or his show spoke about the company in any way deemed negative or defamatory, they would sue. Naturally, Oliver giggled and dove right in, complete with a talking squirrel making fun of the executive's claim. This is the chief executive's claim. He once made, okay, this is true. He made the claim that a talking squirrel told him he should start a mining company.
Well, he later said that's not true, but
right. He
did say that in interviews, multiple interviews.
Yes.
So, of course, they had the talking squirrel on the show.
Right. And no surprise what happened next. The company is suing, saying Oliver's piece was more emotionally devastating than the mining accident that killed some of their employees. It was like one of the biggest mining accidents in U.S. history. Big deal or big whoop.
Yeah. And what a bad way to start off your lawsuit, saying his TV show was worse than the death of your employees. That's kind of a callous comment right there. They were trying to say how awful it was, but in fact, it made them look insensitive and indifferent to the deaths of their own employees. I'm actually surprised that they sued, because you saw the episode. I happened to see it, which I don't usually watch the show. I'm sure everything they said is in the public record. I heard nothing that made me go, wow, he's really pushing a line here. So the idea that they're actually going to give more attention to all of this and sue him, he must be, you know, rubbing his hands with glee.
Yeah, well, I saw this week's episode and he kind of is rubbing his hands with glee, saying, I wish I could talk about this, but I can't right now, but I will when it's over. You can better believe it. And and he, he was very careful. He said, look, I have to be careful because we got this letter. And so I have to be very careful about how we talk about, screw it. We'll just, now, you know, even though he said, screw it, and we're going to talk about it anyway, you know that HBO's lawyers looked over the script beforehand.
And I'm sure they are on every, that show is a show that deals with political and complex legal issues. And I'm sure that they do all the time have an in-house lawyer look at stuff and raise warning flags and say, can we reword this and that, you know? So yeah. I'm not surprised, but I don't think it was unusual that they would do so. That letter made them pay extra attention, but you're mocking the chief executive of an coal company and all that stuff, mocking their business practices. You know, you're going to be careful with what you say.
Well, and the thing is, he didn't even have to mock the chief executive of the coal company because this guy is kind of a crackpot, okay?
So right, well, exactly, and their business practices are horrible, and they're damaging the environment, and so it's not that hard.
Yeah, he just said, okay, here's this guy on video. All right, you're mocking yourself. And so it doesn't surprise me that he then turned around and sued.
Oh, excuse me, we just got somebody's at the door. Oh, hello, thank you, we've just been served.
Right, exactly. Okay, this next story is one we thought listeners from around the world might appreciate, especially if they watch television. Because if you're watching TV, there's a good chance you're watching NCIS.
If you're over 50.
Well, that's true. That is true. The show has been the most popular U.S. drama for 5 straight years, maybe even 6 or 7 straight years now. And last week received the International Television Audience Award for a drama TV series. And that is, by the way, the actual name of the award. It picked up the prize at the 57th Monte Carlo Television Festival. The award goes to programs that had the highest ratings in 2016 across 5 continents, leading me to wonder, what were the 2 out of the 7 continents you left out? Obviously Antarctica, but what was the one that you...
Sorry, Asia, you're out. We don't care about you.
Which one did you leave out?
What other continent could you eliminate? Bizarre.
Big deal or big whoop?
Well, this story really frustrates me, though, because I saw it and thought, that's cool. What were the other shows on the list? What's the number one comedy? What's the number one telenovela? How big an audience did they reach? What were the number 2 through 10 in dramas? How big an audience did they reach? God forbid you be able to find that out, because I looked everywhere and I could not suss out any other information except that NCIS is watched by, how many is it? How many people?
47 million.
47 million people around the world every week. Cool. But it'd be nice to know the rest. I guess that's just sort of inside baseball and we're not allowed to love.
Oh, wait a second. We should rewind a bit and actually just take those 2 words that you said together and just use it as a way to intro Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business, and more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we have a story that literally everybody is talking about. Whether you're in the industry or out of the industry, you are definitely talking about this story about the Han Solo film, which I think is still untitled, okay? But basically, long story short, it had directors, it didn't have directors, now it has a director again. But they were in the middle of shooting the film. They were only 2 or 3 weeks away from the end of principal photography when these two directors got fired, Lord and Miller.
They're the guys who did the Lego movie.
Right. And they did 21 Jump Street and 22 right. Jump Street and Clyde with a Chance of Meatballs. So they're kind of, they were the belle of the ball after the Lego movie.
That's right. And they've been fired. And that happens. It's not unusual in Hollywood that directors leave a film in the middle of shoot. It happened a lot in the old days, I think, because people were on such tight schedules and sometimes they didn't like it. You didn't like what was happening on Wizard of Oz, you dumped them. If Clark Gable said, I don't want this homosexual directing my movie anymore, they dumped George Cukor from Gone with the Wind because he paid too much attention to the ladies, but in a good way by coaching them on their acting. So, you know, it's as old as Hollywood, the idea of a director being fired, but this was really close to the end of the movie. And it's really close to the end of, it's a big step forward for the franchise. So, you know, Han Solo has got to be the biggest slam dunk in a spinoff movie, right? You don't want to see the Luke Skywalker story. You got to see the Han Solo story. So this is a big one for them. And they dumped them. And for about a day or two, it looked bad for the directors, right? Oh, they weren't good on the set. The crew applauded when they were fired. They were falling behind. The footage wasn't good, blah, 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 blah. Now it's 2 days later and it's a different story, isn't it?
Well, yeah, 2 days later, it's okay. Actually, Kathleen Kennedy, the head of Lucasfilm, and Lawrence Kasdan, who wrote the first Star Wars film and wrote this film with his son, John, yeah, they weren't getting along. And specifically, Lawrence Kasdan reportedly was upset about the fact that Lord and Miller, who do a lot of kind of improv, which is how the Lego movie was so funny, they weren't sticking to the script. And Lawrence Kasdan, of course, being the script writer, wanted the script stuck to.
Lawrence Kasdan did not have a co-writing credit on Star Wars. He worked
Raiders.
On the second film, The Empire Strikes Back.
And didn't he have one on Raiders of the Lost Ark, too?
Yes, no, yes, he did, but yeah. not the original Star Wars. That was pure George Lucas. Yeah, so from thinking, oh, did these guys mess up, we have the story of not that these people were too tight, but just that's what they've been doing on all the movies. They have a tight control. They want to have, they say, oh, we want creative people to take risks and do something different, but then they freak out and get scared and say, that's not what Star Wars is supposed to be, and they clamp down. So from two directors in turmoil, the story has become a little bit of a franchise where this has been happening a lot. You had J.J. Abrams had a lot of pushback on the first movie, but he had enough muscle to stay in charge. But Rogue One had a big problem, and they pushed aside the director and brought in Tony Gilroy, who shot reshoots for months. We fired a director from another movie even before he began shooting because his film, The Fantastic Four, tanked, and they got worried about him.
And this was the Boba Fett standalone movie. They were about to announce it. His movie tanks, and they're like, well, hold on. We're not announcing it, and by the way, we're not working with you.
To which I think the people at Lucasfilm would say, yeah, okay, maybe we have too tight control. Maybe we're, you know, pushing elbows back with people a little bit. So they don't like that. They don't have as much control as they like, but the movies are working commercially, aren't they?
Yeah. So right now they have, you know, all the control in the world. And, you know, J.J. Abrams specifically did not want to direct the, you know, episode 8. Okay. He said, I'm out. I directed episode 7, but no way am I directing episode 8.
Did he say because they were such pains in the neck?
No, but now it's pretty much apparent that that's kind of
why. Why did he say anything?
Yeah,
why is it apparent now? You're just assuming, or were a pain in the neck.
He kind of alluded to just how difficult it is to make that kind of movie, how much work it was, how much effort it was, and when all of a sudden on Rogue One, when all of those issues were happening. With who directed
Gareth Edwards?
Gareth Edwards. He said he actually reached out to him and said, "Look, don't take it personally. If I wasn't directing Episode 7, I would have been in the same. You know, whoever it was would have been in the same position."
But he didn't say those people are a problem and I'll never work with them again or anything. He just wasn't as fun as he thought.
No. He never said that. It was more like, "Hey, this is basically directing a movie with a committee and a conglomerate behind you that has specific
needs." Jumping
ahead
a little bit. First, they hired a new director, and that's Ron Howard, to which I thought, gee, that's not his kind of movie. I mean, he did Apollo 13, and he's done big movies, but not really popcorn, big, you know, I mean, I guess the Da Vinci Code, it's mostly a guy standing around looking at symbols. It's not a big action set piece summer popcorn movie. He's made popular films, but not of that nature. But he's a big director. He's been on big sets. And so he obviously would know what to do. But I still thought, I know why they want him, a safe name, a name that people can, you know, say, okay, Ron Howard's there.
Yeah, but you know what?
He'd want to do it.
Well, a couple reasons. And we're talking about him taking over the Han Solo film. One, they know they can trust him. And they know that he is capable of actually stepping in here, as you mentioned.
Well, I would say he hasn't done this type of movie as such. I guess In the Heart of the Sea, that's on the water, that's difficult. He did Rush, which was a racing movie, but he is not a director of big popcorn movies. He's better known for A Beautiful Mind, The Da Vinci Code, which is technically action, but not really. So it seems to me he's more of a drama and actor's director than big spectacle.
Yeah, but I want to go back to those two movies you just mentioned, Rush and In the Heart of the Sea, some of which you may forget, A, were released in the first place, and B, were Ron Howard films, because C, they did not do well critically or financially. He has not had a big hit in a long time.
Right, so we know why they wanted him, and as you pointed out, we guess we know why he wanted them, because he could use a hit. Inferno was his most recent movie, In the Heart of the Sea before that, then Rush, then The Dilemma, a Vince Vaughn, Kevin James comedy, then Angels and Demons, which did okay but fell hard from The Da Vinci Code. Even Frost Nixon and Cinderella Man and The Missing, these have not been movies that have made a lot of money. They've been sort of eking out, getting close to their budget, not tripling their budget, and nobody's lost their shirt on them. You know, a Cinderella Man cost $90 million to make and grossed $100 million worldwide. Not a great success story. So, you know, it's been a long time since the blockbuster seeming of The Da Vinci Code, which was never followed through on Angels and Demons and Inferno, that has sort of petered out, and a long, long time since A Beautiful Mind won the Oscar and made a lot of money. So he really does need a hit, and having his name on this movie could be a really smart move for him.
Yes. Well, there's a little bit of a problem. You just mentioned something, having his name on this movie. Okay. Will he get his name on this movie? Because here's the deal. First off, you had, the key issues here, at least when it comes to, you know, the firing and hiring of a director or directors mid-film is who will receive the directing credit, okay? How will the residuals be apportioned?
Well, that's the contract stuff we don't care about. But the fact of who's going to be the director of the movie of note, I thought, well, it'd be just like the WGA. They got to go to an arbitration board and they'll look at the script and they'll decide who contributed the most and they'll make a decision.
Right.
But you told me that's not how it works for the DGA. In fact, they have no system in place.
Right, because it so rarely happens, unlike writing where it happens literally every five and a half minutes.
But it doesn't seem like it doesn't happen that much in directing. I mean, we've got three examples on these films. Well, at least two with Gareth Edwards. He was well into filming before he was pushed aside, and he, I believe, got directing credit.
Yes, he did, because Tony Gilroy knew that going in. Okay, he was one of the writers. He said, okay, I'm going to do this, and you're going to get the credit. And now, you're absolutely right, Michael. This is not something that happens. Traditionally, it's not something that's happened, but more and more, you're absolutely right. It is happening. In fact, would you like to know some of the movies where it's happened before? You've mentioned one, right? What was one?
Sure. The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind. It's happened all throughout Hollywood history. This is not a new phenomenon.
Yes, but it's happening more and more where it's happening. Instead of it being like 10 years in between incidences, now it's like, oh, you know, 5.5 months between incidents.
Well, those were the same year, by the way.
Yeah, I know. That just so happened. But, you know, 1980 with Superman 2. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, 1998.
You're saying those are the only two movies in 20 years that the director was fired on? I don't believe that's true.
No, I have about 15 since, and those include the 1939, the duel 1939.
Oh, I'm sure this is not a definitive list.
I'm sure
you have not gotten every example of every movie where a director was fired.
No. I mean, I'm sure you're right about that.
You're just naming the famous examples we know off the top of our heads.
Yes.
I don't think it's that uncommon. I'm surprised the DGA doesn't have some arbitration board in place to make these decisions because, you know, it's going to come up and it has.
Well, in this case, you have Lord and Miller being like 2 or 3 weeks away from principal photography ending. And you're saying, well, okay, they worked on the movie for 2 years. They shot the movie for the most part. And all you have is post-production to go through and maybe a few reshoots.
Maybe not a few if like Tony Gilroy, Ron Howard ends up shooting months of footage. This isn't the only problem with the movie. They fire the editor. they hired an acting coach for Alden Ehrenreich, which sounds insulting, but they're like, no, 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 it's perfectly common, because they weren't happy with his performance. So, you know, but they say their footage is usable. They shot the script and then they did their improvisation. So, yeah, Ron Howard's coming in towards the end, depending on how much more footage he shoots.
Right, correct. And by the way, it could mean for Lord Miller, they could lose if they don't get credit, okay? That means all of the royalties and everything that, you know, all their back end, all that stuff, that goes away as well.
Well, that will be negotiated with lawyers. That will not be something that the DGA will, you know, they will be having, they've lawyered up, and I'm not sure that that would be a given. You know, these guys who basically finished the film, they're not going to give that up without a fight.
So effectively what happens is the DGA ultimately just says, we're going to be the ones to decide and everybody has to live with it. Whereas in the Writers Guild, and I've been part of these, you know, years and years ago, where you actually read both scripts, okay, the script written by writer one and the script written by writer two, and you see how much work they did and how much, you know, there's a percentage. If writer two has done a certain amount of work, they get the credit or a shared credit. And here's a little tip. When you see a writer... a writing credit.
Well, and yeah, we all know that.
Oh, you do? Okay, well, all right.
Yeah, yeah. We all know the AND means that they weren't working together, and an ampersand means they were a team.
Correct.
Yeah, but my point is, whatever the DGA rules and what name goes on the film, Lord and Miller will be having serious conversations with Lucasfilm to say, hey, we're getting our piece of residuals. You know, regardless of that, they will make sure otherwise they're going to be in court.
Yeah, and I guess my question is this. Okay, they weren't sticking to the script. All right, if that is true.
Well, they did. No, they did stick to the script. They like to do an improvisational style. That's what they were doing. The studio said, we're very unhappy. Lawrence Kasdan, where are my words? And so they say that they always shot a couple takes using the exact wording of the script, and then they went off on the improvisation.
And so a part of me wonders, okay, because when you do that, you get what's called coverage, right? That way the editor has something to work with. He or she can, you know, cut around things and, oh, gee, this isn't working. Let's try that. And guess what? We have the footage. No problem. Perfect. So, you know, why not do a take where it's improv? Okay, great. Let's move on. You did the three or four takes with where it was, you know, the actual script, and you did one or two that were improv, and then you move on to the next.
Everybody does that. I mean, directors with actors will say, give me what I want, and then you can do whatever you want. Let's do this, and then you can give me all your choices, whatever you want, you know, just to send this, end up using the one that they wanted in the first place, you know. So, yeah, I mean, that happens all the time.
Now, with film, it can be very expensive to do that because, of course, you're shooting a lot of footage.
What is this word?
This film. It starts with an F, ends in an M, and there's an IL in there. You know what? It's something that used to be used more often than it is today. I think they are shooting this particular, the Harrison Ford, I almost said, the Han Solo film on actual film stock.
And then are they?
Yes, okay. I think so. I know that they did that with Episode 7 that J.J. Abrams shot, and he wanted it done that way.
Well, that was a big point, but it was Rogue One shot on film?
That's a good question. I wonder. I'm going to go back and look
should
that
be
up.
Able to know.
Yeah, I don't have it off the top of my head. But I wonder, given that the editor was also let go, if maybe, yeah, you were shooting all of this stuff, both the scripted and the improv, and in the editing room, you were working with the editor and basically putting a film together that we did not want, that went off script. So even though you had the scripted lines, the finished product, you weren't actually using the scripted version.
Okay, I'm not sure what point you're making. They say, the understanding I have today is that they did shoot the script, and then they did improvisation after that.
Right. However, even though you shot it, doesn't mean you're using it in the editing room. And given the fact that the editor was also kind of let go, kind of makes me think that...
That wasn't this week, was it?
The editor?
Wasn't that earlier? I don't know when the editor was fired.
Oh, I don't know either. I have no idea.
Right. I don't have the sense necessarily. I don't know.
And by the way, you might think, well, why not just give both of them credit, okay? Make it an and, A-N-D, instead of an ampersand, so you know they didn't work together. The DGA typically hates giving dual credit. In fact, you can ask the Coen brothers about that. For years, Joel Coen would get credit as the director, and Ethan Coen would get credit as the producer, and they would both get credit as the writer, even though both of them were directing films, until finally the DGA came up with a waiver system where the Coen brothers could go and say, we want a waiver for all of our films, we're directing them together, and they finally got it.
All right. So does this matter? Is there some change that needs to be done to the DGA rules? This is a movie. All the Star Wars films have been commercially successful. There's no reason to think that'll change. If the franchise is troubled, as people want to say, well, only troubled in the sense that they're keeping a lid on it and they're happy with the results because they're making money hand over fist.
Well, I think, you know what? Here's what I would say is maybe the important bit out of this. There's a lot, but in this case, let's just focus on the DGA. As we've mentioned more and more, these films are being made by big corporations, these big conglomerates, and yes, they're going to want to control it a lot more, control the end product a lot more. And so we're seeing an increase of these happening more often, at least on these big studio films where directors are being replaced. So you know what? The DGA should just come up with a system and a method for handling such cases. That would,
Absolutely. Other point is a creative one that you talked about sequelitis earlier in the show.
Yes.
You talked about the fact that all these movies, these popcorn movies, they're being bigger and bigger budgets, meaning there's more at stake. And while some studios say, oh, we want to be risk taking and have young, fresh voices, it's really young directors with not a lot of juice who they can control.
Right.
And say, hey, you know what? You're riding this franchise. Just do it. You know, that's nice. So you got some ideas. You can do this and that. But basically, you know, you deliver what we want. And the result is that, as we've noted for 20 years now, most popcorn movies are terrible. Most
yes.
big studio summer and holiday blockbuster, you know, popcorn movies. I'm not talking about the animated films because that's an area where it works still. They're not good. They're not even close to good. I mean, it's, you know, the glory days of summer blockbuster movies was in the 70s and early 80s when you had one after another, like Ghostbusters and Raiders of the Lost Ark and Beverly Hills Cop. There were all these movies that were fresh and fun and different. Back to the Future. Nowadays, it's like Transformers. You're just hoping it doesn't suck as much as the one before. Two Spider-Man movies that sucked. You know, the DC movies, they had to make three before they could make one that wasn't terrible. You know, and this is a big problem, and you think it's part of this clamping down on control.
Yes, I think that you're basically getting movies that have no vision. They're all directed by committee, and they have the prerequisite elements to them because that's what works in the formula. We're making a brand new product. You know, here are the bits that everybody needs to have in them because this is what sells, or this is what we think sells.
Well, so, you know, we're going to have to wait for the DGA ruling, and maybe they do need a system in place.
Yeah, well, you know, our system is that we do a show each week, and then when we end, when we're kind of wrapping things up, we usually tell our listeners how they can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us, and if you can't, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or give us a call even, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That is where you will find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. It's also where you'll find those ways to follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's a petition, actually. I want you to go to change.org. You can follow the link in our show notes. It's change.org/P/ Daniel Day-Lewis, don't stop acting.
Are you literally going to start a change.org?
I hadn't thought about it, but maybe I should.
Because, you know,
I was just joking, but yeah, why not? That would be funny. Maybe people would pay attention. That would be so silly. No, I can't do that.
So don't go there. Instead, go to, I don't know, the Huffington Post to read some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, or michaelgiltz.com, where all of Michael's work is aggregated. And don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to see what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.